Elisabeth Ruge is one of the best known literary agents in Germany.
Right.
And in a previous life, she was an editor and publisher.
Right.
She was educated in Frankfurt, Moscow, and somewhere in the United States.
Yeah, in Cambridge and in North Carolina, actually, at UNC with Fulbright.
I've been to the library there. It's quite
Yeah, it's a
beautiful.
great
Yeah,
library.
yeah. That's Chapel Hill,
That's
right?
Chapel Hill,
Yeah.
right.
And in fact, Fine Books and Collections magazine is based there.
Yeah, I know, actually.
I've just got a piece going in there on
Oh,
Prague.
great.
Anyway, welcome to the Bibliophile.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor and a pleasure.
So perhaps you could tell me, do you think that this move from being an editor, then a publisher, then a literary agent, is that a natural evolution?
I wouldn't say it's a natural evolution. I don't know so many people who have that kind of history. I think for me it is natural because, in a way, it lets me be very close to the authors again, being an agent now, which I was, of course, as an editor. As a publisher, you're close to your authors, but in a much broader sense, because you have so many things you're making decisions on, you're planning, you're looking at. And now I'm closer to the authors in the sense that I'm closer to the texts again. So there is a almost circular motion. On the other hand, I find that really good literary agents are actually great partners for publishing houses. And only in that function, if you understand a publishing house, if you know how it works, if you know its possibilities but its limitations, then you can really do something for your authors and help the publishers with publishing the books. So a lot of the knowledge I gained while being a publisher has also gone into my job being an agent.
Do you think that literary agents poach the best part of being a publisher?
Well, it depends. It depends. It is great fun, and you're working at the source, so to say. You're there, working on the concept of nonfiction books. You're there working on the manuscripts of novels. But at the same time, I would say, I always, because I was a publisher for a long time, and because I loved being a publisher, it's almost difficult for me to then, when a deal is done, to give over the project to the publishing house and
Yes.
be helpful and accompany the project, which I do in many, many instances, but I'm not making the calls. I'm not making the decisions. In the end, I'm not the person saying we should have this cover or we should change that. And
No.
that is something I miss. So every time there's a little
Yeah.
pain, so
You don't
to
want to let
say,
go.
yeah, it's
Yes.
difficult to let go. Right.
But in the same respect, the publisher has all of these responsibilities so that if it screws up, it's their fault, not your fault.
Yeah, in a way, but screwing up nowadays as a publisher has so many facets attached to it, yeah, and there are so many moments where I would say the publisher isn't screwing up, but the publisher is working in a really, really difficult environment. So that also brings with it a lot of frustration on the side of the authors, and that's where we are again, because we're dealing day to day with these frustrations.
What kind of frustrations?
Frustrations that, of course, in the last 2, 3 years, these frustrations have had a lot to do with COVID, endless amounts of book presentations, events, which are important for authors because they also make money with these things.
They sell
Not,
books,
yeah, they
yeah.
sell books, but they also, in Germany, for many of the readings, you actually get, a salary or a honorarium. Yeah, so
Okay.
especially for young literary authors, it's a really important source of income. So these things were falling by the wayside, were being pushed into the future or cancelled altogether. So that's something that the publisher had to deal with. But the frustration for these things was very often addressed towards us, simply because it's easier to call us, to talk to us about it. So we've had 2 or 3 years of really, really trying to also help our authors through this difficult time. But then again, you know, there are frustrations that certain promises were made in respect to marketing, and then these promises sometimes aren't fulfilled. The sales reps haven't been able to place the book in, with the quantities that the publisher was expecting, and because of that, marketing plans are edited. Suddenly the author sees that things aren't happening that he or she were you know, waiting for. And then they, of course, immediately call and say, hey, the author, the publishing house isn't fulfilling its part of the deal. So what are we going to do? So in the end, you know, we are always rather active in this triangle,
yeah,
which sometimes is pleasant, but I would say in the past years has often been characterized by difficulties, by disappointments also.
So the authors would say to you, look, they're not doing their job. I want you to give them hell.
Exactly. And so often, and I think that's where our agency might differ to a certain degree from other agencies here in Germany, at least, because most of my professional life was taking place in publishing houses. I can advise the authors that some things are really not in the hands of the publisher, and they have a lot to do with the times that we are all experiencing together. And that has a lot to do with the advent of digital in the news world and in the world of newspapers. So there's a total shift of balance concerning book reviews. Yeah, book reviews and printed newspapers are simply not as important as they used to be, because the readership, most of these people are quite old. So for a certain kind of book, there's no value. But authors are very, very focused on that still. On the other hand, publishers sometimes have really not gotten quite attached and active enough with the blogger sphere, because yeah, blogging is so important for book reviews. So a few days ago, an author called and was very frantic and frustrated because he received from a large German publishing house the list of the bloggers that were receiving the advance copies of his book.
Yeah.
And he looked at it and he said, there's just like nobody from the really literary, this is a novel, this is a total hodgepodge of bloggers doing all kinds of stuff. And very obviously, the publishing house hasn't done its research, you know. This was a part of a larger conglomerate, so it was a bit of a surprising shock. On the other hand, I know, especially from independent houses and some houses that are very well run also within conglomerates, that they for several years have already made this effort to reach out to the blogging world, to invite these people into the publishing houses. They've understood early on that people receive recommendations in many, many different places.
Yeah.
And so often it's not just knocking at the publishing house's door and saying, you know, you guys aren't doing your job. It's sort of trying to, in a very polite way, say, I think it would be, you know, valuable not only for this book and this particular author, but on the whole, if you would somehow try to connect more, with these alternative worlds of actually bringing books into the public and garnering recommendations, reviews, and so on. Things are changing. Also, as you know, of course, in the sphere of marketing, printed book advertisement is extremely expensive and almost useless if you're not marketing some huge top seller where you know that you can achieve a point of visibility that is omnipresent, and then it makes sense. But again, authors often think the value that a publishing house attaches to their book is attached to the amount of print advertising that's going on. And so in many cases, we also have to explain things to the authors. It's not only explaining things to the publishing house. So I think a good agency really is a kind of, you know, flexible and creative joint, yeah, between these various worlds of publishing. And of course, our clients, our authors are always in our focus, but I think it's useful to also take into consideration the changes that publishing houses have to deal with.
Hmm. Okay, so day to day, what do you do? Like hour to hour?
Yeah, hour to hour. We do a ton of reading all the time.
So this would be potential clients or reading of your existing clients?
Yeah, reading of our existing clients and then also potential clients. Potential clients, we really only take on people who, at this point, that are recommended to us, either by existing clients or by authors or by journalists we know, because we have such a clients list that we really don't want to expand very much. And on the other hand, because we're living in volatile times, we don't want to take on much more staff. So we're 5 people in the publishing, in the agency, and that's how we want to keep it at the moment.
And you have about 200 authors.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And we also deal with their film rights. So we deal with their book rights, but another very important part of our work are film rights.
I just spent the last month in a writer's workshop program in Prague, the summer writer's program.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to get a feel for what young authors were writing, but also going through. And yeah, pretty well all of the serious ones were wanting to get an agent.
Yeah.
So, but it's not easy, you know.
No,
it's not easy because you want writers that are somewhat established or you know are good. They just want someone to help them get published.
Yeah, to help them in the first step get the attention of the publishing house.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's really just to get them through the door. That
yes.
is so difficult. And that's why this is the first step, why they need agents. In our, when we look at manuscripts, of course, there are, it's very different if you're looking at nonfiction or if you're looking at fiction. So with fiction, you know, we get all these people who write to us, say, I've finished a manuscript. What should I be sending? Should I be sending big proposal? And, you know.
To you, you mean? They're asking what they should send to you. Yeah.
And then we'll send a sample of the manuscript. And we always say, we don't need samples of manuscripts. That was in the old days when you were using, you know, hard copies, sending hard copies in the mail. And of course, nobody should be sending around 400 pages without a real interest on the part of the agent. But by now, you're sending it digitally. So we want the entire manuscript, and we don't really want a proposal. If you want to send a page on what this is about, go ahead. But in the end, with a fiction book, with a literary book, the only question that really counts at the beginning of the process is if this person can write or can't write.
Yeah.
So the story, I mean, we know so many grand stories in world of literature. If we sort of put together the plot in 5 sentences, it doesn't sound like a great read. And then suddenly, wow, it's the most amazing book you've ever, you know, put your hands on because it's so amazingly written. But with nonfiction, and I'm a great, great fan of nonfiction. I love nonfiction and all its various forms, and also the forms where things move slightly into the realm of literature, and you're using all the various, you know,
tools,
that really is fascinating to me, and that's why I really enjoy working on concepts for nonfiction books with authors. And that is really a different thing. And we have ended up creating some, or helping to create some wonderful nonfiction books where in the end a co-author was brought in because somebody really had an amazing story to tell or had an amazing amount of expert knowledge, and but really wasn't up to the task to actually write the book, or the book had a timely quality and you had to get it out there and the person who had the story to tell just wasn't experienced enough to write a manuscript swiftly enough. So we often do that kind of work, and we represent a good amount of authors who, apart from writing their own books, do like to ghost or co-author books. And so that's also a part of our work.
So what are these young authors supposed to do then?
The young authors, the fiction or nonfiction?
That are looking to get you to represent them.
Well, at this point, we really are very cautious on our website, saying we won't be able to answer all the unsolicited, you know, manuscripts and letters. But we try to take a look. But in the end, I think one address is, of course, you mentioned the writers' workshops. Of course, we look into these workshops, who's participating, and there are various workshops here in Berlin. There's a whole array then attached to Klagenfurt, which is sort of the most important literary prize, the Ingeborg Bachmann Prize, that is given once a year. It's several awards in the southwest of Austria, and it really is the most important prize for contemporary writing given annually. And so they have a kind of writer's workshop in advance of the main event of the readings for the prizes themselves. And that workshop is a place where not only we as agents, but a few agents try to take that in before they go to the Bachmann Awards themselves. And because there has already been a kind of evaluation and people have been chosen to take part in that workshop. So you know, okay, somebody
these
has already looked.
They're not published necessarily.
No, they're not published. These are young authors who are unpublished and who get a chance of working with two or three important, experienced authors who work with them in this workshop. And there is a process of being chosen for it. So the readings then are the workshop, not itself, but the readings are public then, and then you get a good idea if there's somebody there who might be working on an interesting novel. And there are several such, you know, events taking place. So that's a place where we do go look actively. But apart from that, I would say most of the authors that we've brought on board in the last 1 or 2 years have really been recommendations from people we represent.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the trick then. You need to get someone to recommend you.
Yeah, you need, I think, you have to get into one of these events.
You have to get noticed. I mean, really, you need to get your writing noticed if you want to get published by someone. But you also have to get and keep the attention of the reader in the writing that you do.
Of course. And on the other hand, within the publishing house, you're totally right. It's all about attention. It's getting the attention of the various people in the various departments of, you know, getting them to feel they're working on a big book that we're going to do together. It's about getting the attention of the sales reps who go out there and get the attentions of the booksellers and, you know, and Amazon and all these large clients. You're always trying to get them to focus on certain books you have. And it's true. And I think getting that attention is really one big part of being successful or being not successful. And getting that attention is also a question of creativity and intelligence, you know, and experience, of course. And just giving that spin, it's really also a question of spin. How are you talking about a book? What kind of a narrative are you putting out there? And that's the great fun of publishing. And that is what I miss as an agent, that I'm only to a certain extent a part of that process. And that is so interesting because we have to create spin to get the publisher's attention. And if we do a good job, then they will carry forward the ideas we attached to a
yes.
manuscript when we were pitching it to them. So in that sense, we often do give something that then is carried forward in the rest of the process. But then these steps within the publishing house itself, you can really sink a book by just not coming up with the right arguments, with the right points why this book is going to work for a bookseller. And you can also give booksellers and everyone out there really ideas of how they can sell a book, why they will be able to sell it, why they should be reading it.
Mm.
And that really is the great fun and joy of publishing, to figure that out, you know.
I haven't heard it put quite that way before. So can you give me an example of a great sort of, okay, there's a book that you think is fantastic. Mm-hmm. What spin did you put on it? Like, it's just like, it's your enthusiasm put into an elevator pitch, it
mm-hmm.
sounds to me.
Yeah.
And this sort of little through line
mm-hmm.
here that mm-hmm. you could, that they would then take all
mm-hmm.
the way from you
mm-hmm.
to try to get that kind of word of mouth going around leaders.
Right. Well, perhaps two examples. One example is a book that is very well known in the English language publishing world, because it was a huge New York Times bestseller for a long time by an author called James McBride, The Color of Water. Yeah. And in America, it was very much read and became a bestseller, being a book basically also about race, about growing up in a society that that offered few opportunities. And the story is basically the story of James McBride's mother and family, a woman a Jewish woman who came from Eastern Europe with her parents, having had to flee the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
and ended up in America, married a black man and raised children with him. He died. She married another man, raised children, more children with him, and all of these children she gave an amazing opportunity, and they all ended up being lawyers and doctors and James McBride.
How did she give them the opportunity? What do you mean?
Well, she raised them in a way that she, you know, gave them the feeling they can achieve something,
right.
And education is important and you better be doing your homework, you know. But she was this little Jewish lady, and here were all these teenagers, children and teenagers, and he just tells the story basically of his mother. And
right.
I picked up this book when I was early to an appointment at a publishing house and a bookstore around the corner, and I had some time to kill.
Mm.
And it hadn't been sold in Germany for months.
You mean they were shopping it around for a German publisher?
Yeah, they had been offered again and again and again, and nobody bought it in Germany because
right.
they saw it basically as a quintessential American, US-American story.
Yeah.
And I started reading it, and I immediately thought, wow, this is a story about a Jewish woman who had to flee with her family from Europe and came to America and fell in love with a black man and decided to marry him. And her family, her father was a rabbi actually,
mm-hmm.
said, if you do this, you're going to have to leave this family. You know, you're leaving your family. We won't put up with this. And she did. And they had six children together. He died. She married a man who himself had a few children he brought into
was
the second
black
marriage.
Well? Hmm? Was he black as
and
well?
And he was black as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And she raised these children. And I thought the pitch in Germany here is this little Jewish woman who took these courageous decisions and helped these children grow up to be these successful Americans, you know, grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an amazingly amazing story that has to do with coming from Europe, has to do with loss, has to do with Jewish heritage, and so on and so on, and mm-hmm. making these decisions. So, mm-hmm.
life-affirming.
Yeah. So I bought it, and here, basically, it was picked up in Germany. We pitched it as her story, and it was picked up here in Germany by a lot of the very important Jewish bookstores, and he came over and gave a wonderful, wonderful reading tour where he basically traveled with one of our leading Jewish book people, Rahel Salamanda, through Germany to 4 or 5 various events, which were all sold out. He had, you know, he was a jazz musician, so he also played music. But for us here in Germany, it really was a story that had its roots in Europe, in a Europe that was being destroyed by the Nazis, you know.
Yeah.
So this woman who made her way with her family to America had already experienced dreadful things, had experienced loss, had understood that you have to, you know, muster courage to get on with life, to build a new life for yourself. And so what her son then had to tell about the family she herself then founded, it was quite clear that those roots and those early experiences had formed her in a way that made it possible for her to achieve this, yeah? So in Germany, it was read very, very different, and it really was a totally different elevator pitch, yeah?
Yes.
Then from the pitch that was very important to American readers, where this was very much a story about race and about the American society, because the focus was very much on the author himself. We took the mother and put her into the focus, and it worked. It was a bestseller here in Germany.
Now, was this when you were a publisher? Because you said you bought it.
Yes, yeah, when I was a publisher.
Yeah. What was the publishing house?
Berlin Verlag, a publisher, publishing house that I co-founded with my husband and a friend of ours, and that subsequently was then bought by Random House, and we bought it back, and then we sold it to Bloomsbury. So... It was a great adventure and great fun. But that's where we published James McBride book, and the other book I might want to mention as maybe one of my most amazing experiences as a publisher was Jonathan Littell's Le Bienveillant, which we published here in Germany.
This was that brick, right?
Yes, it was that brick.
Even though I didn't make it all the way through, I wanted to, because I think I read the first 100 pages, and it was one of these things where I just got, but I do want to come back to it, because those first 100 pages
are amazing.
Dynamite.
Yeah. And of course, here in Germany, it was it was a huge responsibility that you had as a publisher, because it was very clear that in Germany, this book could be put off as something that was sensation-seeking,
Was he evil, or I can't remember? The protagonist
was
evil, right?
And
that's what we were doing
here.
So
that's why, and it was told from his perspective. And that already was, of course, something where I could already sense the critics, you know, saying, here's somebody who sat down and he decided, and that's what some of them said, you know, how can I write the most provocative bestseller, you know, and I'm gonna take this character and I'm gonna let him tell all these evil, you know, moments of Nazi rule in Europe, and this is terrible, and so on.
But also explaining how a regular, normal person could get caught up in that and feel those thoughts.
Yeah.
Because he explored them all, right?
Yeah. But that's something that many critics weren't. We could already feel the energy, the negative energy and the hostility, brewing.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, what can we do here? We're not going to be able to convince all these people that that this is a great book. You know, they might not like it, and that's not our task here.
Mm.
What we have to do is we have to hang the bar so high that even if they criticize the book, they criticize it on a very high level. So we have a discussion here and not a trashing of this book, yeah?
Right.
And it was really fascinating. So what we did was, first of all, our marketing campaign, the way the catalog pages were designed, there were no photos of the author. It was all very, very simple, elegant, austere almost.
I think it's a white cover. In
France,
in
it was published by Gallimard,
mm-hmm.
so it had the Gallimard cover.
Yeah.
So we basically did a German take on the Gallimard cover. There was nothing. There was just type. And we said the most important tool for our marketing purposes is that we're going to have a booklet that we will distribute far in advance, several months in advance, with interviews, with discussions on the book as they happened in France, with material to show how the author, the depth of research, what he did on his walls. We had photos of all the various organigrams that he had put together. And Frank Schirmacher, who unfortunately is deceased, but really was the most important man in German feuilleton, in German arts and letters, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
One of the main people at the Frankfurter Allgemeine. He came across this booklet, and I remember I was on the train when he called me and he said, This is amazing. I have to read this manuscript. And so I sent him.
If we could just back up. Okay, mm-hmm. Who put that booklet together?
We did. The German publisher, I did, basically.
You did?
With the editor.
And mm-hmm. this was Berlin Verlag?
Verlag,
yeah, okay.
This was Berlin Verlag.
So where did you send that? Did you send it to all sort of influencers?
We sent it to,
and it was printed, right?
It was printed. We sent it mostly to editors, important newspaper editors,
okay.
TV, radio, cultural programs, to important booksellers.
Yes, okay.
And we just got it out there. And we also sent it to some of the historians. We knew that there might be a problem with historians here in Germany who say, well, this is all not quite up to academic standards and so on. And what we really did achieve, that there was a huge battle that was then fought around this book in Germany.
Which is what you wanted?
Well, we wanted it to be on a high level. So there was no critic who wrote less than a full page, newspaper page,
wow.
you know?
Wow.
So it was everywhere. And we had one critic, Klaus Habrecht, who was a very important German sort of grand seigneur of arts and letters here in Germany, who was married to Renate Habrecht, who is the sister of Anita Lasker Walfisch. So she had survived Auschwitz and Berg-Belsen. And this was his wife. So he was very, very sensitive. And he wrote an initial review, huge review, which was very negative. And 2 months later, literally 2 months later, during the Leipzig Book Fair, he wrote a second review, which was a double page of the Frankfurter Allgemeine, where he said, this book has sunken in and it's started working in me and it's done something and I must sit down and write another review. And it was a favorable review where he said, I've only slowly understood what this book is telling me and what its great importance is for us to understand the Nazi years and how and masculinity within this Nazi culture and the huge destructive energy that came upon us, came upon our societies in Europe due to this this warped, strange cult of masculinity that had a lot to do with Germany coming out of the First World War.
Well, being humiliated and exerting
exactly,
itself.
Exactly, all these things, you know, all these things, which all these false narratives that were put out. But
the book itself, was it criticized because it made him look human, or that he wasn't entirely evil, that he looked... I guess the real concern was that it might be seen as justifying what took place. Was that the argument?
No, I think the argument was more... the book was charged with a huge amount of sexual energy as well, which had to do with the idea of this Nazi masculinity cult also having... to do with suppressed homosexuality and all these things. And Littell really delved into that and immersed himself into this world that he really dissected in a very interesting literary way. And that was something that people really went up against. So you had critics who were saying this basically is pornography. Yeah, this is Nazi trash pornography.
Right. Misogynist?
Yeah, misogynist, but more just exploitative.
Like rape scenes and this sort of thing?
It had a lot to do with fantasy, with fantasy worlds that, and coming out of that world and feeling empowered to do certain things, or justified to do certain things, and really this accusation of pornography was one of the main points in the camp that was anti this book. And we had a huge poster, which I still have in the agency, where we, after about 2 or 3 months of reviews and critiques of this book, we sort of juxtaposed the various quotes from all of Germany's great critics.
Wow.
And it was wild. It was, one camp was saying, this is brilliant, this is one of the most important books that have ever been written, literally saying that.
Yes.
And the other camp saying, this is... scum, this is, you know,
this is 50 Shades of Grey,
this is terrible, and it was fascinating, but it really took Germany, the German readers, by storm. And we made sure that in the end there was a fruitful, valuable discussion about this book, and it was a big bestseller. It sold as a hardcover and then as a paperback, and Littell was amazingly important here in Germany, then also as a commentator on various political issues like the downfall of the Soviet Empire, the Georgian War. He was extremely important. I published an amazing book of his on the Syrian Civil War. He really was someone who had come out, and that's what made me so interested in him. He had worked for various NGOs and had been in all the conflicts, working and active in all the conflicts of the post-Yugoslavia confusion and all the war and conflict scenarios that came out of that. And so when he sat down and wrote this big book, he was really writing about the source of human evil and trying to understand how can that happen? How can people who lived side by side in a village turn around and start killing off each other, just a few months later? How does that happen? What happened in Bosnia? How can we explain these forays into genocide, So I was totally convinced that this was a serious person
Well, you're buying the author, aren't you, in a way? I mean, you got to know him before you bought the, right?
I didn't get to know him personally, but I did look
into his story,
and I found him to be absolutely convincing. And I never, you know, people were saying he's a charlatan,
right,
but he absolutely wasn't. And he was very courageous, and he was obsessive. Otherwise, you can't write that kind of a book. But I found him to be fascinating, and I found him to continue to be fascinating when he went into these other scenarios that unfolded in Europe and especially in the Arab world in the years after. And he did prove to be someone that that was published widely then in German newspapers. These other books were published, they were, you know, reviewed, and he was seen as somebody who was an amazingly important explicateur of what was going on in these in this conflict-ridden era that we've moved into since then, you know.
So how come no one else bought it then?
Oh, that
was that auction?
Littell was a big auction, yeah.
Okay.
We got the book, even though we paid a sum that was six figures.
You took a risk, a
below,
big one.
No, below the highest offer. So we were the underbidder, actually, in the final round.
So he was wanting to be published by you that much?
Yes, we wrote a long letter where we explained why we were so interested in this book and found it so important and what we were going to do.
What was in that letter?
In that letter was, first of all, just a basic reading of, you know, our reading of his book and placing it in the history of literature on this period.
So very flattering.
It was flattering because we liked the book very much, but we weren't using these terms, you know, the usual terms. We were really trying to explain by looking at other important and big books that had been written about this period, trying to understand how this could have happened, and setting it off and saying, why is this different? What is happening here? And then also explaining, as I, you know, said earlier, why we found him to be so convincing and reliable as an author. It was very important with this kind of book that can be read as a utter provocation. You have to be convinced as a publisher. You have to be convinced that this person who is sending the book into the world is someone who is, it's reliable. Reliable is really the word, you know. You know he researched, he has his reasons. And in this case, he really did have his reasons, because he had been working with these amazing NGOs. He had been out there, he had witnessed this human behavior, this pattern. And he decided to sit down and write a book set in a period of history that up till today, one can argue, was just the hugest moment of human atrocity, and using that as his laboratory, packing into this book all the things that he had witnessed firsthand and had to somehow process. So we explained to him why we found him to be so convincing, and then we explained to him what we would do and what we wouldn't do, you know, how we wouldn't market this book, that we wouldn't be marketing it in a very loud fashion, but would really be focusing on the text and on his background. And I think he felt, which is very often important for authors, he felt that we were passionate, but that we were also out to protect him. And protecting authors is a very big part of what you do as a publisher, you know?
Protecting legally, you mean? Or
no,
what?
Protecting them from being misread, from, you protect them, first of all, the first step where you protect your author is by being an excellent editor. Because every author I've met in my professional life is highly, highly nervous about publishing a new book. even if he's an accomplished best-selling author. The moment that book goes public, almost all authors I know are nervous wrecks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
he had credibility. Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of course.
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
needed to
right.
ensure
yes.
that what? That when he was put under the spotlight, he wasn't gonna he wasn't gonna what?
Well, he was gonna be able to explain or to
justify or
no, not justify, but simply present himself as someone who is
worth listening
to. A serious
yeah.
person
yeah.
who has depth and has knowledge and has an existential interest because of his experience in telling this story.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
protecting authors always means in the first step giving your author the feeling that his or her book is as well edited and as perfect as it can be when it goes out there is something that I find to be so important for as experienced by an author that I've often felt if they feel protected in that way when it comes and they become very successful, they'll often stay with the publishing house, even if it's an independent house that cannot offer the same kind of money as a big conglomerate. They'll stay because they rely on that. They rely on that kind of editorial passion, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
it gives them confidence.
It gives them confidence, and they feel somebody is holding their hand over me, yeah? They've
mm-hmm.
done everything. They've been critical, they've been attentive, they've been passionate about this, they've been, you know, they've been there through all the various stages of the manuscript and the proofs and so on, and they've pointed out, you know, even in the final stages, we have to do this or that, yeah? And that kind of reliability, I felt, is often the much stronger glue, yeah, when it comes to binding authors to your publishing house than many other things that publishers can offer. And here in Germany, I don't know what it's like in the English language world, but here in Germany, especially in the big houses that are often under the roofs of conglomerates, I've noticed that often publishers work more and more with freelance editors. So the editors are not in-house, but they're freelance. And that, I think, is a development that is really detrimental to publishers, because that just knowledge that that an author has, that in that publishing house is that editor who knows his text at least as good as he knows it, if not even better. And he's in that house and he's taking care of that book. That is a totally different feeling from working with someone who's hundreds of miles away from that publishing house and is, you know, messaging back and forth, but is not how on the ground, yeah, I would say. That's a development that I find to be really dangerous. And I find that many of the publishers that have been most successful in the past years are really publishers who have strengthened their editorial departments and have not weakened them by, you know, often it's just an economic question that you think things are just, you know, more, they add up more beneficially if you have more people out there doing this freelance work.
Yeah.
But I think that is really, in Germany, we say that's a milkmaid's summing up of things, yeah? Which means it's not going to work. It's not going to work. You're saving money at the wrong place, you know? You really have to, I think, in this day and age, you really need strong editorial departments. That's the most important part of the publishing house, because a lot, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, a lot of the traditional, standard, conventional marketing tools don't work anymore. So I think one really has to take a good look at marketing departments and figure out what has to change, you know, what kind of shifts towards the digital. Do we need different kind people with different kind of, you know, knowledge, different kind of tools that they bring, and are there perhaps departments that are still relatively large but really belong to a past era? But what never changes is the importance of good editorial work. And I think I know many authors who in the end also, and we as agents often say, yeah, go for it, who say, you know, we'd rather go with this or that publishing house, even though if we're going to take smaller contracts, because we just know there's this full attention. I mean, there we are again, you know, attention. Attention means time. Time and focus
and caring about,
yeah,
about
and
it.
And that's an economical aspect, because the people stay in your house and they'll stay with you even if other places.
Well, they'll stay with an editor, I think.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the thing, won't
right.
they? I
right.
mean, and if an editor leaves a publishing house
yeah.
and goes to another
yeah.
one, often they'll take
yes. right.
Writers with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because of exactly
yeah.
what we talked about.
So if you have a bunch of freelance editors, you're not going to have that kind of, you know, effect as a publisher looking at your editorial team and knowing some of these grand authors you have here are really here because
one person
they
who, yeah.
love their editor
mm-hmm.
and they value the work of the other publisher parts of the publishing house, no question. But that one person that is not, you know, that can't change for them is really the editor.
So the conclusion here is that you should get a bunch of freelance marketers, but don't.
In a way, if you need...
Because they're not connected to that relationship,
yeah,
are they necessarily?
Yeah. If you have the feeling, you know, you have to do something about your numbers
yeah.
at your publishing house. I mean, on the whole, of course, I would always favor everything to be in-house because I think that in this sense, this word synergy is often used for things that never happen, you know, when
yeah.
big conglomerates,
yeah,
you know, come together and
yeah.
everything is happy because of the synergy and it's like zero. But
yeah.
but in a publishing house where departments work together well,
mm.
I mean, that is wonderful. It's beautiful to see.
Yeah.
But we all know there, you know, there's number crunching going on, but I would never do the number crunching at the expense of the editorial team. I would always take a look at the other components because I really do think that's where you really have the loyalty and
the love,
ability
the
to
love.
Keep your authors with you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and just we're already on an hour here, so I don't want to cut into your Denmark time, but it's interesting in this writer's program that I was in. This, I think, is what they were craving was people to pay loving, caring attention to their texts to help them with it
yeah.
and to make it better so that more people will pay attention
yeah.
to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And time, as we all know, is a commodity of huge value. And what
yeah.
we're talking about here, when you use the word attention, it's basically time, you know, quality time.
Yeah.
Time
yeah.
in the sense of focusing and looking at that text, working with that author.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, you know, our conversation has been carried by several terms. And I think, you know, most important is this term attention, and it's really the quintessential work of editing, the editorial work that I started with when I started my professional career in publishing, and that has always been at the center of everything I do. Even as a publisher, I was still an editor.
Mm-hmm.
And as an agent, I'm very much an editor. And I think that's the one building block that really makes this world tick, and also enables us to, as readers, come across magnificent books, because the wonderful editors are there to accompany their wonderful authors.
I could end it there, but I just want one more question.
Sure.
And that has to do with Lytle's book.
Mm-hmm.
He went straight at a really controversial topic.
Uh-huh.
And these days, we've got sensitivity editors.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Would his book have been published today?
That's a good question. I think this, of course, is a huge field where we could spend the next hour discussing just this topic.
Yes.
I think there's much to be said for sensitivity editors. I do feel that I myself have learned a lot about usage of language. And I think this whole big issue about political correctness, cancel culture, all these things being at the heart of everything that's going wrong in our society, I think is really BS. Yeah, because I do think that these things have their absolute justification.
Yeah.
And so it's very important. I do think that when you look at literature has to be provocative. Yeah, but the provocation has to be attached to a very serious enterprise. Yeah, and so I would, I think as an editor, as a publisher, I would always fight for a book like Jonathan Littell's, because I think that his provocation is grounded in enormous earnestness. And I feel if you look at it as an intelligent reader, it's the exact opposite of being misogynist. It really is about men at the center of many of our historical, contemporary, cultural problems, and not men as men, but men who are tied up in certain ideas, concepts of masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is, in that sense, it's,
so it questions,
it's a very
that?
Early book. Yeah,
questions
that. Yeah.
And enables
absolutely.
A conversation on it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know. So the problem always is that you'll always have readers who will find things in books that they will reduce to some simplistic and then negative narrative, and they'll take out the complexity. And of course, good literature is always a very complex affair.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll always have discussions around that, but I find these discussions to be valuable. And they point at certain things, issues, roles of individuals and societies that are sensitive. And I do think that we live in a time where many people whose perspective was seen as the dominant perspective through decades and centuries are having to get having to get used to the fact that there are many perspectives, and other people want their perspective to be perceived. And I think that's absolutely justified. And something we have to fight for. And I think literature is a great vehicle to engage in that battle.
Well, thank you so much for one of the things that I believe is that books aren't complete unless they've been talked about.
Yeah,
unless there's serious conversation around them, so that more ideas can be explored.
Sure.
And more books written. What a fascinating conversation I've had with you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, I'm glad it worked out because it's been great fun.
Yes. Now, can I get you to do the extra? I've been speaking with
Elizabeth Ruger, who started her publishing career as an editor, founded publishing houses, worked as a publisher, and is now a literary agent in Berlin, Germany.
And is off to Denmark.
Yes, is off to Denmark for 4 days with family.
Very good. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.